Chronogram Conversations. It's about the Hudson Valley.
Move our city to the country, to the country. With all our silverware and books about the country. With cans of sardines and our bitmaps and our fancy jewelry. We'll move our city to the country, oh yeah.
I'm Brian Mahoney, editor of Chronogram Magazine, and this is Chronogram Conversations, my chance to talk with the people who make the Hudson Valley tick. Welcome back to Chronogram Conversations. I'm Brian Mahoney. You may have noticed our new theme music. A big thank you to our friend Tracy Bonham for letting us use her song, We Moved Our City to the Country. It's our new theme song. I'm very excited about that. And thanks to DJ Dave Leonard of Radio Unleashed and JTD Productions for helping us put that little bit of production together. This week I'm joined by Max Wattman, author, raconteur, back to the land kind of guy, a Cold Spring resident. He just came out with a book, Harvest, Field Notes from a Far-Flung Pursuit of Real Food. It's kind of a Michael Pollan meets Gary Steingart kind of a deal. A grisly, funny business of growing your own vegetables and raising your own livestock and how everything can go wrong. Humor writing, of course, is the most difficult.
Yeah, well, because, you know, I always say you're like a... Oh, you remember when there used to be real DJs instead of just clear stream everything?
Yeah.
And, you know, you'd listen to some guy at, like, 1 o'clock in the morning sitting in a room by himself making jokes and be like, God, man, you need an audience. You know? Just so you know to shut up now. Sometimes I feel like my whole life is like that, you know? I don't know. It's funny to me.
Well, you know, I think it's when you approach it from a kind of a oblique angle, maybe...
Yeah.
You know, and I think when you're writing about food, the comedy can come in and not seem forced.
Yeah, I hope that's true. Thank you. Yeah, I think that's right. In general, it can. I mean, certainly there are guys who beat it to death anyway, and sometimes very well, you know, like Jeffrey Steingarten.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's putting out flags going, I'm being funny now. There's nothing oblique about it.
Right.
And it still works. But I think, sure, there's a lot of room for, like, well, it's probably part of the hominess of the whole thing, right?
The hominess, what do you mean?
Of just that, like, you know, eating is something we do intimately with people in our house, you know, or even if we're out, it's a kind of an intimate scene. And I think that, you know, that you can make jokes in the same way. You know, you're
right.
Kind of invited along, you're invited in, you're at the table, too.
Sure, and I think, you know... situational stuff is much more interesting than just a kind of a, oh, I just flew in from Cold Spring, you know? Anyway.
Yeah, take my wife, please.
Take my dead chickens, please.
Yeah, please.
So let me ask you the most important question. What are you eating these days?
The same thing. Well, I'm still eating bubbles. You get 366 pounds of beef, man. It's going to last a while. So I'm still eating steaks.
Very nice. And so what cuts are on the menu?
You know, I just made a pot roast out of a shoulder chop, a big 4-pound slice of shoulder that was just, it was amazing. I mean, it continues to surprise me, that steer. It's just so beefy. For lack of a better word, it really tastes like something.
And did you have to get another fridge to store bubbles?
Oh, I got freezers upon freezers upon freezers, yeah. Whole basement full of freezers.
And
many, many eye rollings from the wife for the bought another freezer moment.
So in the book you recount trying to make brajol and it goes wrong. What went wrong?
It's really hard to tell what went wrong. You know, the problem with a mysterious activity like that is that so much of it is done away from you. You know, if you're cooking something, you know the moment that you've blown it. You know, I burnt that is a really direct cause and result of why the dish is ruined. But with something like that, you know, you've tucked it away and the the chemistry is working and the spices are working, and it was great when I checked it halfway through, and it was ruined when I checked it done. So, you know, when it should have been done. And
so when you're curing meat, what goes on? So let's say I know nothing about curing meat. So what did you do to try and make this brajol?
Well, it's the coolest bit of science that I have, I think, which is that salt through a permeable membrane will try to create two equal balances of salinity. So it'll pass through and try to make things inside something just as salty as they are outside it, which is how we discovered ham. We used to just bury it by the seashore, and the salt water would wash over it, and it would become salty inside the ham. So what you're doing is you're taking water out of the meat and putting salt into it by packing it in salt. That's the first step. And then the second step is an aging process where that continues, where the water evaporates and the meat cures. And that happens, or is supposed to happen in this case, in a little wine fridge. I used to just hang it under the eaves of my porch and it would go fine. And then when I did it, you know, the right way with scales and measurements and a fridge, a controlled environment, it blew it badly.
And so do you know what went wrong?
Not really. I mean, I can guess that maybe there was a humidity problem, or I can guess that I had introduced a bacteria into it at some point along the way without meaning to. I mean, every time you touch something, you potentially contaminate it. But even the guys who are the best at this, Alan Benton once told my dad, actually, it's a hearsay bit of story, but that he opens one out of every 15 hams or something, and they're wrong for some reason. They've gone bad.
And this is a guy who is world renowned for his hams.
It's what he does. Yeah, he does it professionally, and people ship them, you know, all over the world, and they're highly praised, and they still blow it sometimes. And I think it's just it can go south. You know, I mean, it's one of the things that everybody talks about when they start talking about, you know, so you want to make cheese or so you want to cure your own meat. And everybody says, and I think they're right too, that if you don't have a sense of what the difference is between something you should eat and something you shouldn't, you shouldn't do it at all. You know, that if you're going to look at something and say, I don't know, maybe I should eat it, just skip the whole process, because you're controlling a rot. You know, when you're making cheese, what you're doing is you're rotting milk in the right way. Well, what are the chances that you're going to win that argument every time?
Right. Well, you had that wonderful quote from Kafka in the book about nature. What was it exactly?
In the bed against view against the world, back of the world.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it should go without saying that, you know, you're kind of trying, but it doesn't mean you're going to make it. You know.
Right. So, you know, the brajol didn't work out. A lot of failures in the book. I'd like you to read a short passage about raising chickens, and then we can talk about that a bit.
Sure. This is from the chapter called Living with Girls. Penguin died early, before she was 2 years old, of what I termed sudden chicken death syndrome. She simply dropped. I walked out to the coop, and she was lying in a heap by the watering font. It was a sad, mysterious moment, but very much the sort of thing to which one must be inured. To care for chickens is to carry their corpses. They are vulnerable birds. Insects can beat a chicken in a fair fight if they get themselves organized. The birds are susceptible to all sorts of maladies and mishaps. Most of all, everything likes to eat chickens.
I love that passage because it kind of, in a way, sums up, you know, the whole tenor of your chicken raising experience. You know, you had a problem with varmints.
I did.
And you got a gun?
An air rifle, among others.
Yes, yeah. An air rifle. I don't want to put you afoul of the local authorities.
Exactly, anymore.
Yes. And but you never managed to use the air rifle to any effect, did you?
I shot at the raccoon, and I hit him a bunch of times. I assume that was discouraging, but it didn't stop him. I mean, I shot him four times, I think. Because by the end of it, he had driven me mad. I would stay up all night in my little writing shed waiting for him to walk down the little pathway in the backyard. I put cans of cat food out there and smeared peanut butter on the slate. And he would show up, and sometimes he would step into a shadow, and as I say in the book, you know, I was just sane enough not to go shooting into shadows, because I know that's how you end up explaining to your neighbor why you shot their cat. But he was terrorizing me, or I was allowing myself to be terrorized by him, I guess.
Yeah, I had a similar problem last year with a groundhog that had been eating all of my lettuces, and I, too, procured an air rifle from a friend of mine, and I was up there in my second story window one morning, like, you know, Oswald in the book depository, waiting, and I see this thing come out, and lo and behold, I have it in my sights, and literally at that moment, my dog runs outside and gets in the way of my shot. it was so annoying because the varmint was eating all of my lettuce.
You got to have a talk with the dog, first of all.
Well, the dog actually remedied the situation later.
Good.
Yeah. But these animals, you know, can ruin things for us. So how did it turn out with the chickens?
They all died, every single one of them. And it's infuriating, as you say. They can ruin everything we try to do. But what are they supposed to do? They don't know that. The chicken is delicious. You know, I've fed it on cracked corn. I mean, it's a wonderful meal for a raccoon. Your lettuce is right there. You know, you put it there for him, as far as he's concerned. I don't know how we can blame them. I mean, I think it's part of the deal. We try to defend what we do, and sometimes we fail at that too.
Mm-hmm. So, what was the big idea here? You know, one of the things you say in the book. You know, you wanted to live on a farm without being on a farm.
Well, I think that a lot of the solutions that are presented to people about how they might eat better food or how they might deal with what they consume in a better way, in a way that makes them happier, they're just untenable. You know, you watch somebody recount how they ditched their city apartment, they moved out to the country, and they started farming. And you say, but I like my job, or, you know, my kid goes to school here. What am I supposed to do? And I just think it's a lot to ask. And so a lot of what I wanted to do was make adjustments. Now, I go too far at everything I do, so my adjustments end up pretty sweeping and untenable themselves. But I think that what I was trying to do is show people that, you know, you can go as far as you want, and you can screw up along the way, and you can try again, and you can do little bits of it, and you can pick and choose. And so I think it was just a kind of attempt to make a, you know, make a solution that people might actually enjoy doing, or that I might enjoy doing, most of all.
Right. And you mentioned, you know, at a point in the book, you know, that while you're kind of taking everything to the nth degree, that, you know, meals should be fun.
Shouldn't they?
Well, but, you know, I think that you're reacting to this idea of sanctimony and, you know, this kind of secular religion around locavorism that's developed.
There's so much of it. I mean, there's so much time spent berating people, and there's so much of a scolding culture at work now. And I think, you know, people have a lot of anxiety about what it is that they're eating. I talked to someone once who had just read that she thought they were feeding the remains of humans to pigs in California. Like, that's how crazy people can get, which is obviously not true. I mean, there's no way that is happening anywhere. You know, Soylent Green is not people, not yet. But it doesn't seem a stretch to folks, I think, because they've been driven crazy by a seemingly endless system of rules. I mean, you know, pollen's got only a few of them, but they sure do resonate outwards and seem to take up a lot of time once you start really narrowing down what you could feel good about eating.
Right. So how do we get around that without, I mean, for those of us, you know, who, as you mentioned somewhere in the book, you're talking about raising chickens, and, you know, you're like, it gives me a routine as someone who just sits around and stares at the wall every day and wonders when cocktail hour is going to start. You know, For those of us, you know, who are chained to our desk all day, you know, it's difficult to kind of source, you know, all of our food and then get home in time with, you know, getting the kids or what have you and putting a meal together. I mean, how can we do that?
It's hard. I think that you can set up a system. You can start building things a little bit at a time, and you can just start. You start with chickens. Buy better chickens somehow. Find a good source for them. make your own chicken stock, you know, learn how to bone them and break it down, and you've got three meals right there. I find myself, you know, despite the fact that I write about food and spend a lot of my time thinking about it, I am often 25 minutes out from dinner with no idea what is for dinner. And I think if you can build a small array of things that you can do in half an hour that don't take that much work, which is most everything, really. I mean, it doesn't all have to be kind of Iron Chef ready constructions. You know, you can brown a chop and steam some vegetables in 10 minutes. You're done.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've spent some time paying attention to where those things come from, I think you'll be fine. You'll be free from the anxiety of eating horrible things from cruel machines.
Right, which brings us to that pink slime burger that you had. And you and you didn't mention the restaurant, which...
I couldn't be sure 100% which one it was. I could throw a lot of accusations at a lot of restaurants, but I don't think it matters ultimately. It's more that out there somewhere, there's this patty of mushy, slimy byproduct that's being masqueraded as food.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be. You know, it shouldn't be. I mean, it's just not, and certainly you shouldn't eat it. I mean, I guess people can try to sell it. But I wish they'd stopped. And, I mean, and you could, you know, it's within your rights to just leave that stuff behind.
Right. And then try and make hot dogs like you did. And do you, so the hot dogs didn't work out like many things. And do you still have the sausage in a freezer?
I do, actually, yeah. They half worked out. They tasted great. I mean, it was meat from a steer that I'd bought as a yearling, you know, that I'd ground myself. And it was flavored really carefully, and it tasted wonderful when I did what they call the canal test, which is just, you know, make a little patty of it and fry it up by itself. It tasted absolutely like a hot dog should taste. But then it's very... it's a very gummy sausage. It's very smooth and it's very thick, and I couldn't get it to push into the sausage casings despite real effort. I mean, I eventually was in such a kind of weird fury about it. I had it on the floor, and I was pushing as hard as I could with all my weight on the thing, and hot dog paste was spurting up behind me and coating all my cabinets, and made a terrible mess. And, you know, I don't know that I count that even as a whole failure. I mean, I tried to do it.
It's a good. Half failure.
It's a half a failure.
What's your scale of failures here?
How many? How long?
Yeah, like the spectrum of failure. There's like full failure,
mostly failure.
Yes.
Complete and utter failure. Yeah. There's really disappointing failures. You know, like the Brujol was a really disappointing failure. The hot dogs was not.
You tasted the Brujol, and you mentioned in the book. Your wife was looking at you and your buddy like you were both crazy.
Well, it probably wasn't the smartest thing I've ever done. The first taste had to be done. We went back for a second taste just to try to really figure out what was going on. And I think that was the moment at which she was just, you know, aghast that this was the kind of thing I would do. It's hard to look at something like that, 4.5 pounds of that same steer, ruined, and not try to experience what had happened to it, you know. And the only way I knew was to taste it,
right?
Try to see what it really tasted like, and it tasted terrible. It really tasted like it wasn't good for me. I mean, that was an example. As I was saying, there's no confusion about whether or not you should be eating that. You should not be. You know, it's terrible tasting.
And you make a point in the book that you say, you know, not only, you know, do you want to be making your own food, but you want it to be better than store-bought, which kind of gets us back to this whole idea about sourcing, I would guess.
It does, and technique. That's the name of a book that was very popular when I was a kid, Better Than Store-Bought. And it was a great idea that you could make your own waffle mix, you could make your own pancake mix and stuff like that. What happened as a result was that a lot of people ate pancakes that were not nearly as good as Bisquick. And that's always struck me as kind of a ripoff. Like, you're going to go to all the trouble to make the stuff yourself, and then in the end, you're going to get this thick, dense, mealy thing that somebody's going to insist is a pancake, and you know, you're going to have really unhappy children, basically. So, and I think it's very discouraging as a kitchen process. If you know, if that's what you're trying to do, and then you end up and you're like, well, it's, you know, it's kind of all right. It's almost as good as the bisquick we ate last weekend. That's, you're not going to keep doing it. So part of my goal is always to, if I'm going to do it myself, I want it to end up better than it would have been if I'd just gone to the store and bought it.
Right. Of course, now with the rise of the artisanal culture, you can actually get people who are making pancake mix, you know, in their house or wherever, their, you know, whatever agriculture approved place. I saw recently something, it was brine. You could buy the brine that you were going to, you know, put your bird in. And I thought that was the kind of the apotheosis of this thing. Like, can't I just put sugar and water and salt together?
The absurdity of it, for sure. Because, yeah, what are they selling you? Yeah, that does seem like a silly product to buy. It would take anyone a minute and a half to discover how to make a poultry brine on the web. You know, just Google it. You're done. You're already done in as much time as it took you to Google it.
Mm-hmm.
You will have finished the entire thing. Yeah, I think that there's a lot to... But it's not all a ripoff. I mean, there are a lot of wonderful people making wonderful stuff. I mean, you can buy great pickles at the farmer's market. You can buy great breads everywhere now, or most places. And at the same time, I think that you learn a lot by making things, by getting your hands dirty, by doing it yourself. Mm-hmm. And what you might learn is that you don't want to do it all the time. I mean, I think that the person who learns they don't want to make their own brine for chickens is, I don't know. That's
right.
But the person, you know, but it's completely fair to realize that you don't want to make your own bread every time you want some bread. Because
right.
That's a lot to do.
One of the things that you turned me on to was about sauerkraut and kimchi.
Yeah.
And, you know, you mentioned, you know, Sander Katz, and we've interviewed him for the magazine, and he's a big hero of ours. And, you know, but that's fairly easy to do that stuff.
It's very easy. You just salt it and chop it and mix it up.
We're back.
All right. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
It is very easy to make your own sauerkraut and to make your own kimchi. You just chop stuff up and salt it. I mean, and Sander Katz has gone so far as to suggest it almost doesn't matter what vegetables you use. You know, he'll make it out of anything.
Yeah, what was the weirdest pickle you've ever made?
I don't know that it's weird. I made some beautiful kimchi out of watermelon radishes, which are these giant, they're like the size of your knee, and they're purple fading into white. With some red tinges and stuff. They're just beautiful and weird looking. And so I used turnips and watermelon radishes and chopped them up into little, you know, like bigger than a julienne, and salted them. They were fantastic.
Mm. And so, right, anything can go in there.
Sure.
Right. Although you do mention, you had a funny turn of phrase in the book. You were talking about the kind of the oppression of seasonal eating, this idea of, you know, how many turnips can you eat? It's as if seasonal eating as practiced in the gulag.
Yeah.
You know? And we certainly, those of us, you know, who belong to CSAs and have gardens, you know, you do get this kind of seasonal fatigue.
How could you not? I mean, at the end of turnip season, is there an end to turnip season? You've kind of had it with that stuff, but it's nice because then when it comes back around, it's fresh again. You know, you can stop eating them when they're out of season, and then start again. My wife burns out on that stuff much sooner than I do. I've got much more patience for asparagus when it's spring.
You seem to have a special relationship with asparagus based on what you wrote in the book.
I do. I like it a lot. But I only have to eat it for, what, 3 weeks, a month, and then it's gone.
Right.
You know, and I think it can be oppressive. I mean, one more round of corn on the cob by the end of the summer, you're pretty tired of it, right? But how much do you want it now in February?
Oh, that's the whole thing, right? Because I look at the tomatoes in the supermarket and I go, don't be fooled.
Right, yeah, don't do it. They look good, but they're not going to do it for you. Yeah, just wait, and then you can... I think that extends your tolerance for the crush that is seasonal eating. You know, and at the same time, I think it's important to well, it's important to find a good CSA, people who plant lots of different stuff and can actually harvest it.
Right.
And then to augment that with stuff that in your own garden that they're not making. You know, like I stopped planting kale in my garden because it comes from the CSA. You know, there's plenty of kale in kale season. But you know, maybe they don't actually mind us. But you know, if they don't plant enough tomatoes for you, plant some of those. If they don't, you know, if they don't give you enough garlic, plant that. There's other things you can always flesh it out, mm-hmm. and you can fill in the gaps.
So, in the book, you really were all over the Hudson Valley. You went to cheese making school up at Hawthorne Valley in Columbia County. You got your sausage casing over in Walden, of all places. And the Hudson Valley now, and this is a conversation I continue to have, seems to be really, coming to this kind of pinnacle as a place for food, agriculture, distilleries. You know, certainly, I'm sure you're aware of all these places that are popping up around here.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so what's your take on, like, the Hudson Valley as this kind of food mecca?
Well, I think it always has been. It's certainly more so as, you know, as we grow more and more farmers markets and people get more and more involved in this stuff, it's just becoming more so. I think what has happened in the past, I've been here for about 10 years, is that a lot more of the food drove by me on its way to the Green Market in Union Square in the city. And I feel like now some of it stops off. There's some places you can go to get it around here before it makes its way down to town. At the same time, I always come to the realization that the Hudson Valley is great, but you've got to be willing to get in a car. You know, you've got to be willing to drive up to Ghent and go to the Hawthorne Valley School or over to Walden or wherever it takes you. If you're going to limit yourself to 20 minutes or something, you probably will be disappointed. You won't think that it's got this incredible bounty of stuff. But if you move that out to an hour and a half, there is nothing we can't get.
Right. Have you been drinking any of these white whiskeys that these distilleries are putting out around here?
Of course. Well, I mean, it was the whole point of my last book. So they finally stopped mailing them to me, I think.
Oh, well, that sounds terrible.
Yeah, they should start again, actually. but I love them. I think they're great. I'm always surprised that they're so contentious. You know, there's a lot of argument out there in the spirits world about what you can call it. Whether or not there's even such a thing as white whiskey, because whiskey in its legal definition is aged in wood or stored in wood for a little while, and a lot of the white whiskeys are not. Same thing goes with calling stuff moonshine. That, you know, moonshine, the only really workable definition of that is that it's illegal, which it certainly isn't by the time it's on the shelf at the liquor store.
Right.
You know, but it seems to me kind of beside the point. You know, what with all this, I mean, the labels are already on the bottle. We should stop arguing about whether or not it exists at all. And I think it's also, we've passed the point where it's just a kind of revenue stopgap. You know, for a long time, a lot of distilleries simply had to release it because they had no other product.
Right, while the other stuff aged, they had to have some revenue.
You've got to keep the lights on somehow. And I think it's been proved that people enjoy it and that some companies are good at making it. I mean, the Hudson Corn Whiskey from Tuttletown is great stuff. You know, why wouldn't you drink it?
Have you had the stuff from Copper Sea over in West Park?
I've had some of it. I don't remember which iteration of theirs I've had. What do they make?
They're making a white whiskey, and they're doing some, I think there's some eau de vie, but I think the white whiskey is, you know, their main thing. And I had an interesting conversation with one of the distillers over there who was talking about being at a farmer's market with his product. And, you know, it's a white whiskey, and he's selling it for, I think, like $45 a bottle, you know, which is a premium price. And somebody tasted it at the table, handed it back to him, and said, oh, that's really tasty. And he said, how much is it? And he tells him it's $45. And the guy tasting it goes, why would I pay that? I could get it for half as much in the store. And then Christopher said, well, you know, you're talking to the guy who made it. You know, it's
right.
Made from local ingredients. You know, I can tell you the full story of it right now. And so it's, and, but that, it, when I spoke to Christopher about this, it brought up an interesting, you know, conundrum to me. While I would like to support that as well, you know, the price point is a tough nut to crack for some of us.
It is, and I think that that's true across the board on all of these small-scale handmade products. I mean,
right?
You know, on the one side, your spinach isn't inherently worth more just because you didn't grow very much of it. You know, it's not really fair to put the burden on the consumer of supporting your farm because you haven't figured out a way to make a farm viable. At the same time, if you want there to be farms and you want there to be people working to make food nearby, you do have to kind of pay them a premium for it. I mean, it's a tough nut to crack, though, because as I write, you know, it's certainly true that there's a false economy that keeps meat prices low, for instance. It's vastly subsidized, incredible tax incentives for big ag commercial meat products. But at the same time, the false economy in my house is the only one I have. It's not like I get refunded the $10 spread if I choose not to buy meat at a, you know.
You're not getting those checks?
No, right, yeah, where's my meat subsidy back? So when you're looking at that and you're saying, well, you know, the brisket at the supermarket's $3 a pound and the brisket at the farmer's market's $13.50, that's a tough call, I think. And I don't think there's an easy solution to that. I mean, I think eat less meat and pay more attention to what you're doing, sure. You know, try to carve out a little bit of money to buy some white whiskey from a local maker, absolutely. But it does seem like we've got to reach some kind of balance.
Yeah, I agree with you there, and I think that if the products are good, you know, they will succeed. I get concerned that these become, you know, elite or luxury goods, you know, and it's a, you know, this is an ongoing concern because I understand that, you know, to make these small batch, you know, items, you have to have this higher price point in many respects. I have to say, a lot of the produce is not that expensive, you know, when you put it up against stuff that you buy in the supermarket. So I think that many farmers have started to figure that out.
I think that a lot of the price points are justifiable. They're not arbitrary. I mean, I think that, you know, a small distiller can take you through the process and say, look, here's what this costs us and this costs us and this costs us, and we added this up and it's the same margin. You know, they didn't just quintuple the price because it was handmade.
Right, right.
It's asking a lot of the consumer. I think you've got to find niche consumers for that. From their point of view, they've just got to find niche consumers that really appreciate and adore what it is that they're doing. And then suddenly it's affordable.
And I think, you know, especially with distilling, we're seeing that, you know, the more distilleries open, the more the market for them continues to expand.
Absolutely. Yeah. How could it not? And then once you've got a whole shelf of local products, as I've seen in some liquor stores where it's, you know, all the stuff from New York State gathered together, I think that's a big help in that. You know, you're no longer tucked in between very familiar bottles.
Mm-hmm, right, between the Maker's Mark and the Jim Beam.
Because your eye, I think, would move right over it as just something you'd never seen before. You know, whereas now it's kind of called out as something special. I think that's going to be a big help. And I think people learn more about the process and they just become better drinkers and better consumers of that stuff.
I've been trying to become a better drinker for many years. So, but let's talk about your hunting experience.
Sure.
So you went off to kill a deer.
Well, at the end of the book, I went upstate to kill a deer. I did not kill a deer. I just read a book on my phone and got really, really, really cold while I waited for a deer. You know, I think like a lot of people, I don't really have the, I don't have that hunting built into the schedule of my life yet. So it's very hard to successfully take a deer if you just got up one morning and went out to a field, you know, on a friend's farm where you might have seen one last summer.
Yeah,
you
know? No, I had a very similar experience many years ago up in Delaware County, friend's farm. We went out at first light, and I'd never, you know, done anything like this. They handed me a gun and a six pack of beer at 5 a.m. and they say, you go that way, you know, we're all going to go in our separate directions. And I said, is it all right if I bring a book? Right? Because I'm like, I'm just going to be sitting out in the woods.
Yeah.
Right? And they're like, they all looked at me like I had, you know, four heads. They're like, no, you can't bring a book. I brought a book anyway.
Of course you did.
Of course I did. But it was dark, right? For the first, you know, hour. So then I'm like, well, I guess I'm here by myself. Maybe I'll just knock one out, right?
Yeah.
So I knock one out. Great. I read the book. I go back at like 9 o'clock for breakfast. So I'm like, so, what do you guys normally do when you're sitting there in the dark? And I'm like, you know, I was there by myself for more than half an hour. I abused myself. And they all looked at me like I had just revealed the great, like, you know, you're not supposed to say that. I'm not going to ask you if that was your experience, but you were reading The Master and Margarita, which is a lovely book.
It is. It was fun. It was absurd. I mean, it is that boring. It is just painfully cold, no matter how geared up you are. You know, I don't care how good your gloves are. You're going to be cold 4 hours in, you know, and you're starving, you know, poking at the beef jerky in your little backpack that you brought with you going, you know, that is so not the like heaping bowl of mashed potatoes and stew that I want it to be. I think, you know, not that it's a bad thing to do. It's a great thing to do. And I love sitting in the woods for sure. Bird hunting is much more exciting. There's a lot more moving around, which suits my ADD. Mm-hmm. Basically, you know, you get to walk and look at stuff. I went to North Dakota to hunt pheasants, and that was a more exhilarating experience. You know, nobody would ever call deer hunting exhilarating. I guess it is when the big buck breaks through the tree line and, you know, you're about to shoot it, but I've never had that experience.
Oh,
so I can't
yeah,
say.
No, when I went hunting, I actually, because I was such a novice hunter, I saw a deer and it started running away, so I started chasing it. I ran like a mile thinking I would just come over the rise and see it.
There it would be.
Yeah. No. But how did pheasant hunting go?
Pheasant hunting was wonderful. I mean, it wasn't exactly what I expected it to be, you know, because when my friend said that he went pheasant hunting in North Dakota, it sounded like something Teddy Roosevelt would do. I think I expected that we would arrive in our own private train car. But, you know, it turns out it's just a little working farmhouse. It used to be a working farmhouse, you know, a little farmhouse on a lot of land with a bunch of wild pheasants around. We hunted 6,500 acres of the prairie. And, you know, watching the dogs work is amazing. They're really attuned to birds, you know, and they're so energetic and they leap and they have such an intense relationship with the person who's calling them and controlling them. And they have such an intense relationship with hunters in general. I mean, they're always kind of running up to you and checking you out and making sure that it's okay and then working right in front of you in a kind of goalie box to make sure that anything that they would flush is within your range. And it's just interesting how with you they are. You know, usually I kind of think of dogs as they're your companion, but if, you know, you're outside, they're just running. These guys were definitely running with a purpose. And the birds themselves are beautiful, and the hunting is amazing. I mean, to shoot one, you know, they fly fast, and you really feel like you've done something when you bring it down. It's an incredible experience. I love it.
How many did you take?
I think, let me see, that year I took 6, I want to say.
Mm-hmm. And how good of a shot are you?
Well, it depends on the day. I went again and wasn't a very good shot. But I got one on the first shot I took, which felt like I must be doing something right. You know, it depends how much you practice. I mean, I think anybody can shoot a shotgun if you practice a little bit and you manage to keep your nerves under control.
And not shoot your buddy in the face, say, right?
You know,
like,
exactly.
Like some politicians have been known to do.
It's a good idea to look before you pull the trigger. You should be pretty sure. It's just like shooting stuff in the shadows, you know? It's a really good idea to know exactly what you're pointing a gun at.
I'm going to be, drinking some whiskey soon and bourbon over in Dutchess County. Maybe you could join me over there for a little tour.
I'd love to. Where are you going?
Well, you know, there's some new places have opened up. Millbrook Distillery is opening up.
Yeah.
And Dutchess Spirits. Have you heard about this place?
Sure. I know that guy a little bit.
Yeah. So I was thinking about heading up to Hill Rock as well.
I'd love to go to Hill Rock. I've been trying to get up there to see Danielle Eddy since they started it, and I just haven't made it yet.
Yeah, I haven't made it yet either. Yeah, well, I'm thinking in the next couple months, once Dutch's and Millbrook are up and operational in their new locations, or their, you know, once their locations are open.
Right, and once it's not, once we don't have to walk through this nonsense to get to their door.
Tell me about it.
You know, I'm sure a lot of that tour happens outside. I'd rather not do it in 7.5 degrees or whatever we're looking at. But in the warm spring, absolutely. I'd love to come along on that. Lovely. That'd be a lot of fun.
Let's do it.
Cool. That'd be great.
All right. Well, I love the book.
Thank you.
It was kind of like if pollen was funny.
That's a stretch.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, it's like, you know, if you kind of filtered him through Gary Steingart a little bit, I think we can get to where you are.
I love that idea. I'll take that.
Yeah. And it's, you know, the personal journey is great.
Thank you very much.
And just one final thing. So do you consider yourself, now that you've written this book, a quote-unquote Hudson Valley writer? And does that have any resonance for you?
Yeah, I guess yes. Yes, absolutely. I mean, I love the Hudson Valley, and I've lived here longer than anywhere else at this point. I mean, I have a strong streak of Southerner left over in me, but I ought to stop admitting it. Or insisting upon it, or whatever it is I'm doing.
I mean, if you want to fight the war of Northern aggression again, that's fine. We can make that happen.
maybe on the third distillery in, we can try it out.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it is so great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you, Brian. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Chronogram Conversations. Our theme music is Tracy Bonham's double-edged love letter to upstate living, We Moved Our City to the Country. If you have any thoughts or suggestions on the show, email me at brian@chronogram.com. Thank you.